Good afternoon. I'm happy to call to order this House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development this fine day, February 23rd, 2015. Today we have a plethora of bills from our Oregon Vehicle Dealers Association primarily. I think we will just take them in order unless anybody has any objection. I will begin by opening a hearing on House Bill 2263 and turn it over to Mr. Brennan to tell us a little bit about this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2263 directs the Department of Transportation to take action necessary to ensure that department policies and activities are implemented in a manner that supports enforcement of the offense of acting as an unlicensed vehicle dealer, a dealer without a certificate. So I could go into more detail, but since we have the folks right here,
I think we have the experts in the room. Thank you, Mr. Brennan. I'd like to call to the dais Daryl Fuller and Amy Joyce, representing the Oregon Vehicle Dealers Association and ODOT. Welcome to our committee this afternoon. In no particular order, I'll let you two choose.
This bill.
Mr. Fuller.
Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon Vehicle Dealers Association. Good afternoon. Thank you for taking the time to hear these
Welcome.
Bills. First of all, as we go through the bills today, I'll note just a couple of things. First, in the state of Oregon, you hear a lot of people talking about a licensed motor vehicle dealer or a licensed car dealer. The state of Oregon does not license car dealers. We certify car dealers.
Thank
so
you.
So as you look at the language and look at the statute, it talks a lot about the certification process or certifying. I actually asked legislative counsel at one point what the difference between a certification and a license was. They were unable to answer the question. Someday I'd like to introduce a bill to replace the word certification with license all through the statute, because everybody talks about licensed dealers, and most other states have licensed dealers. Mm-hmm. So if you look at my written testimony, I've tried to be real careful and use the word certification, but as we talk today, I will probably fall into the habit of calling them licensed auto dealers or talking about the licensing or illegal activity by unlicensed dealers. So with that caveat, the only other thing that I will tell before I briefly talk about this first bill is my philosophy as a lobbyist is that everything that I request in terms of legislation is a housekeeping amendment unless somebody proves otherwise. So all of these things are really simple and easy to just move through the process, and I appreciate that. House Bill 2263, and by the way, I have testimony on all these bills on OLIS, and so if I refer to my testimony, it should be available to you on OLIS.
Thank you.
DMV business regulation does a lot of things, most of them having to do with vehicle dealers, but not always. They deal with billboards and they deal with vehicle dismantlers and tow trucks. But when it comes to motor vehicle dealers, they primarily have three functions. They license those dealers. They certify the dealers by reviewing the application, make sure they meet the statutory requirements to get a certification as a vehicle dealer. They're responsible for renewing those licenses and answering complaints that people have about certified vehicle dealers, making sure that they're following the law. Vehicle dealers are one of the largest tax collectors for the state of Oregon. We collect title and registration fees, and that brings in a lot of money to the state of Oregon. So we have an agency agreement with DMV to collect those taxes and fees for them, and they make sure we get that work done correctly. Also, part of their charge is to go after people that are doing this activity in an unlicensed or an uncertified way. So you have people out there who are selling cars as a living, but they don't go through the process of getting a certification from DMV. Within the industry, those people are called curbers or curbstoners because they put their vehicles out on the curb and sell them without a license. Those people generally are the kind of people that provide the most harm to consumers because they don't follow the same requirements that motor vehicle dealers are required. So we believe that the DMV Business Regulation Division, and they have a number of investigators that are spread around the state geographically, and their job is to look at not only the current licensed dealers but also the unlicensed dealers. But there's nothing in statute that directs how they spend that time. And we believe that most of the harm occurs by curbers, not by certified dealers who are out, for the most part, trying to do things correctly. There are certified dealers who make mistakes, and they need to have people come in and correct them. There are certainly certified dealers that sometimes are not honest, and we hope that the investigators find them and go after them. And the investigators are generally complaint-driven. They're going after consumer complaints that they hear about. But without wanting to hamstring DMV by saying you have to spend so much of your time on unlicensed dealers or dedicating so many employees to going after uncertified dealers. The purpose of House Bill 2263 is to provide some statutory guidance to the DMV Business Regulations Office that we believe as dealers that the unlicensed activity ought to be one of the more significant parts of their day and that they should be focusing their attention on where the most harm occurs, and we believe that's with the dealers that aren't following the law to get their certification to do business correctly. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Joyce.
Chair McEwen and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. The bill, as I understand it, basically says, you know, DMV, do your job, which is fine. DMV does its job in the business regulation world. You know, what I will say is that this section has gone through a little bit of reorganization recently, and I think it's the new direction of the most recent manager is to focus, place some more focus and redistribute workloads somewhat more in the area of looking for folks who are completely outside of the regulatory scheme and a little less time on focusing on the folks who are already within the regulatory scheme. That said, you know, again, it's a bill that says, you know, DMV, carry out your duties, which DMV is very happy to do.
Thank you. Yes. Representative McLean.
I guess the first question I'd have, just usually if you have legislation, we're trying to solve a problem. And so I was wondering what the magnitude of the problem might be. How many folks have we investigated and found to be in non-compliance or not part of the system in the way we want them to be? And I don't know who, I guess it would be a question for you, Amy.
Chair McEwen and Representative McLean, and this is not to say anything necessarily bad about the bill, but I don't have those numbers for you. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, the bill says DMV, do your work, and DMV is going to do its work. So I'd be happy to follow up with numbers on how many folks are licensed or how many people get investigated and that sort of thing.
Madam Chair and Representative McLean, if I could add to that, we believe as a dealer body that DMV is improperly staffed. They ought to have more investigators to be able to go after more of these people. You can drive in almost any community and drive by a Safeway or a Fred Meyer, and you'll see cars on the edge of the street with signs in them that say for sale by owner, and it's a phone number. If you were to pay attention to those phone numbers and drive around, you'd see the same phone number on several cars throughout a community, because those people are selling cars for a living, but they're not licensed as a dealer. The difficulty for the DMV investigators is it does take a lot of their time to find those common phone numbers, to search out where the phone numbers go to, track the vehicle histories and find those people. But I, and again, this is all anecdotal, but I would suggest to you that in any community in Oregon, you could go and find multiple unlicensed dealers if only we had the staff time to go out and find those people. And the DMV Business Regulatory staff does what they can, and they will respond, and some of my licensed dealers will tell the investigators, check out these cars, and they'll do it as they can with their responsibilities. But we do believe it is a significant problem. The law in the state of Oregon says that if you sell any vehicles for a profit purpose, vehicles that you do not plan to, that you did not title in your name and that you did not use for your own purposes, you only have to sell one to require you to get a license as a dealer. So anybody who's doing that is doing it with unlicensed activity. And there are certain caveats in there. If you're a business and you're selling a business vehicle to buy another vehicle, you used it for business purposes. But people who buy vehicles specifically to sell them to make a profit, all of those people by law are supposed to be certified by DMV, and there are a lot of them that aren't.
Mm-hmm. Just to clarify, so if I'm a private owner and I have a vehicle that I'm trying to sell, and I go park it down in the Safeway parking lot with a for sale sign on it with my phone number on it. That does not constitute me being an unlicensed dealer.
Well, Madam Chair, that'd be correct. Obviously, you'd want to get the permission of the property owner to allow you to display the vehicle. Some of them
are
okay with that.
I park it in front of my house.
But if the vehicle is titled in your name, then you have the right to sell it. And DMV even starts to look at people when they title vehicles in their name. If you title 8 or 10 vehicles in your name and you have all of them for less than a year, they might still look at that and start to question why you're buying and selling, using vehicles, so many vehicles at one time. But generally, in that point, you're selling a vehicle that you've used for personal or home use. In that case, you would not be an unlicensed dealer.
Vice Chair Davis, you had a question?
Okay, thank you, Chair. This is for Amy. Amy, would this bill do anything? I mean, would, if it were passed into law, would there be a response by the department?
Chair McEwen and Vice Chair Davis, anytime a measure is passed into law, the department pays attention to it. I don't know that there are any tasks specifically that could be implemented. I think Mr. Fuller described it as kind of a policy direction. I think, you know, DMV could ensure that that policy is part of its operating procedure.
Paula?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm wondering if something to the effect of a budget note or a requirement in the department's budget that a certain shift of resources take place to investigations, if that would have a similar effect.
Chair McEwen and Vice Chair Davis, you know, the business regulation section of DMV is a very small section. It's completely, well, not completely, I shouldn't say that. It is largely fee-driven. And the business regulation section is also sort of monitored and advised by an exterior group, the Oregon Dealer Advisory Committee. It's a statutory group, meets quarterly, representatives from the dealer industry, the dismantler industry, the towing industry, the insurance industry, any number of different entities involved in the vehicle sales area. So there is an oversight of this group, and DMV participates actively in that, staffs it, in fact. And so, you know, certainly a more robust bill would tell DMV to do different things. A budget note could tell DMV to do different things. But as it stands, the bill indicates a policy that, as I think I indicated earlier, DMV is already sort of moving in that direction of focusing more on the malfeasors rather than the folks who, you know, are already within the regulatory scheme.
Madam Chair, sorry, if I might, Vice Chair Davis, we looked at some of those things, too, and we're treading a thin line, if you will. One of the first things that we looked at was the notion of, well, what if we said that DMV has to have at least one full-time investigator that does nothing but go after unlicensed dealers? The problem with that is investigators are geographically based, so we would take somebody out of a geography and then have them running all over the state. It makes more sense the way they're doing it now with a geographically based investigator. And we don't want to say you have to spend X amount of your time, because what if they have a big case and they have to drop working on a big case that they're dealing with because they're not putting enough hours in this other corner? Certainly from the licensed dealer's perspective, one of the most important things is that they process applications and renewals quickly and get that back to us so that we're doing our activities in a correct way. So if there were a flood of new applications for dealers, we wouldn't want DMV to come back and say, well, it's taking us an extra long period of time to process those new applications because we have to spend a certain amount of our time by statute investigating unlicensed activity, so we can't spend it where we need to. So we sort of struggled, as you're struggling now, with how do we tell them we really want you to focus on this area without binding them so much that we inhibit them from doing something else that's also important. Mm-hmm. And we have not found a more artful way than what you have in front of you to sort of do that. This is an important thing, and we're certainly open to suggestions, but this is as best that we can come up with at this point.
So the red flag has been waved. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Darrell, is there some figures you can give us on how much more money your dealers will make if the department stops all this illegal activity?
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, it's a good question, and it's really difficult for us to know because the universe of unlicensed dealers is an unknown universe. We don't know how many vehicles are being sold by people who are unlicensed simply because there are so many out there, and we don't have the department, DMV does not have the resources to go and find those people. A little later on, when I testify on a different bill, we're going to talk a little bit about the Department of Justice and some other tools that they have to go after these people, but the amount of time and effort that's required to sleuth these people out makes it really difficult to know how many sales we're losing and how many customers are frankly buying vehicles from people that they assume are licensed mm-hmm. dealers. And don't realize that they're not having the protection of the bonding that's required for us and some of the other rules and regulations that we follow. The consumers are really at risk, in a lot of cases, just don't know it. And so I apologize, I don't have an answer to that question, but it's just really hard to quantify.
Representative Benz.
Well, Madam Chair, so I was really obviously going to how much more your dealers would pay to the department to buy that additional help. And I was just going to your argument you must have made to them already, which was, well, if you'd like to pay the department some more, then I'm sure they'd devote that money to the public safety that comes from having licensed folk doing this work, and secondly, helping drive more business to those who are actually playing the game correctly. So I'm guessing you had to say exactly the same thing to them when you were discussing why you probably wouldn't recommend an increase in what they paid. But I don't see another way of getting it done. Sad as that message is to carry back to the dealers. You're going to have to pay more to get more protection for your business, you would be saying. I mean, have you already had that conversation? Have they said no, hell no, or what have they done?
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, we've supported, I think, every fee increase the DMV has recommended for licensed dealers for as long as I've represented them. We've looked at, this was many years ago, the Department of Justice did an audit of the DMV Business Regulations Division and determined that too much highway fund money was supplementing what was happening in business regulation. We get a certain amount of money that we can get from the highway fund. The Department of Justice determined that that they were getting too much. So the DMV at that time came to the dealer body and said, we need to triple your licensing fee in order to keep the same number of investigators. And all of the dealer associations at that time supported a tripling of our licensing fee just so we could keep the same number of investigators employed. And if there was an environment where, you know, we believed that the number of FTE could be increased with a fee increase and that could get through this process, we would more than likely support that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You may as well, Amy, Ms. Joyce, I believe you're on the next panel. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2263 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2264. Mr. Brennan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2264 authorizes civil and criminal forfeiture of motor vehicles sold, offered for sale, bought, traded, brokered, exchanged, or displayed for sale by persons acting as a vehicle dealer without a certificate. As with the last bill, we have no amendments for this measure. It has no revenue impact. And as with all the bills today, none of them have received review by LFO because they are not scheduled for work session.
Thank you. And again, Mr. Fuller and Ms. Joyce, welcome to the panel, and in any order you choose.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon Vehicle Dealers Association, will mention that Ms. Joyce and I have an agreement that I'm always right unless she disagrees. So as we go through the process today, if I make any mistakes, she'll be sure to point them out to you. We have worked with very cooperatively with DMV Business Regulation over the last years, trying to provide them with the tools they need in order to go after unlicensed activity. The cost of being an unlicensed dealer used to be a civil penalty of up to $1,000. Well, if you're selling 10 or 15 cars a month, a $1,000 penalty becomes the cost of doing business, and so what? So we increased the penalty up to a per vehicle penalty. So now the DMV has the authority to penalize an unlicensed dealer up to $5,000 per vehicle. And what we're finding is that the career criminals who do this for a living are still saying, so what? Because they just don't pay the fine and they keep selling cars. And there are not significant enough tools that give DMV or whoever DMV has collect their fines on behalf of them to go after these people and get the fines. On OLIS are a couple of DMV investigative reports against a single individual, Mr. Bukovich, who's actually been in jail and who has over $50,000 in outstanding levies against him from DMV. He hasn't paid a penny yet. He has no intention to pay a penny. And if you looked him up today, you could find and go buy a car from him if you wanted to today. So one of the things that we were looking for is what can we do to provide DMV or law enforcement with the tools they need to go after these career criminals that, and in many cases, these people are rolling back odometers and they're doing lots of other things that are unscrupulous. This person was actually featured in a KOIN Channel 6 TV special back in 2010. Kerry Tomlinson, who's their consumer reporter, when he was selling a DeLorean, they went after him. He's rather famous or infamous among the dealer body, but he's only an example of the type of people that DMV, it's not that DMV doesn't want to get the person out of the business or at least have them go to a different state to apply their business. They just don't have the tools, we believe, in order to do that successfully. So House Bill 2264 lists the unlicensed sale of motor vehicles as one of the four pages of reasons that a person's vehicle can be seized as part of illegal activity. And so we believe if somebody like Mr. Butnick Bukovich, I'm going to give up trying to pronounce his name. I apologize. If he's got several vehicles listed for sale and a $5,000 per vehicle penalty that he's never going to pay doesn't work, then let's take the vehicles and let's take the cash proceeds. If we can go back and find that he's sold five or six cars and we can figure out how much he paid for those cars, then let's get into his checking account and start taking the money, the proceeds of his sale, away from him. And if we can create enough of a financial disincentive to sell vehicles illegally in Oregon, then people like him perhaps will stop doing what they're doing to move on. We don't anticipate that this statute would be one that would be used regularly. Fortunately, there's not a huge pool of people that are so incorrigible that they continue to do this. But as long as we as a state continue to allow that activity to be lucrative, they're going to continue to do that. So this is simply an option, we believe, that would be in certain circumstances a way to help disincent people from selling vehicles without a motor vehicle dealer's license. And with that, I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you.
Oh, ma'am, I'm sorry. I should also point out, we do, if the bill should have support to move forward, we've worked with the Department of Justice and would ask for an amendment that clarifies that somebody who is a bona fide purchaser for value, which is somebody who buys one of these vehicles from these type of people, that we wouldn't come and seize their car. We're looking for cars that they would have ownership of that we would seize prior to a sale. So the Department of Justice has asked for some language that would clarify that, and we certainly support that. At the same time, the bill is limited right now to seizing only the vehicle, and we would want to expand that by amendment to allow us to seize the proceeds of the illegal activity as well. And so I apologize for not mentioning that, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Ms. Joyce?
Chair McEwen and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. I don't have much to say about this bill other than that DMV would not be the one in the business of going out and seizing cars, that sort of thing. As Mr. Fuller mentioned, this is a kind of a Department of Justice, pardon me, activity or law enforcement activity. So that's, it would be, I think one of those proverbial tools in the toolbox sort of thing for the worst of the worst.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what does this make this, as far as crimes go? Is this like a felony, or what is it? I'm looking at all the things down below here in Section 3, and I was just wondering what all those other crimes were.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, serious. Representative Bentz, and I don't know the answer to that question. There was somebody from the Department of Justice that was hovering in the back. I don't know if she's still here or not, or if she'd have the answer to that question, but I certainly would be happy to get it for you. But I'm not sure that the seizure automatically creates a different crime other than providing them with a tool as a result of the unlicensed activity.
Hmm. Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you both again for your testimony. To play off the tool in the toolbox, I'm just concerned that this may be a hammer when we need a scalpel, or that we could be applying a pretty broad penalty to go after a few people in the state who may be acting fairly egregiously, and that may be a question better directed to the Department of Justice or even our prosecutors, I suppose, but maybe it's more of a comment than a question, but if you'd like to respond, please do. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair, Representative Davis, I'd rather not, but probably prudent that I do. If there's a way to narrow it and still provide other tools, I would be happy to do that. Again, to get a law enforcement agency involved in one of these cases is pretty rare and only happens when there's, you know, some significant theft going on, if you will, as a result of the illegal activity. So I don't know how you provide sort of a broad brush when it's needed and have it be a scalpel when it's needed.
Yeah.
So again, I would anticipate this would be rarely used, but there is evidence on the record that there are people for which the current penalties simply aren't providing enough disincentive to do the illegal activities.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you. And I think I figured out what's bothering me. It's the, and it's just what I think Representative Davis just mentioned, it's the broad nature of the forfeiture application, because that I'm going to take a guess and say that most of the folks that are probably engaging in this incorrect activity don't even own many of the cars that they're busy displaying. They're probably there on consignment, or they've got a 10% arrangement, or they've got some crazy deal where they don't have the money to buy the cars, so they're just selling them and taking a commission back. This looks to me as though if someone was crazy enough to put their car out in the front yard of this guilty party, goodbye car. Is that how this would work?
Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, it would not be our intent, and again, we'll be asking for clarifying amendments. It would not be the intent of the legislation to go after anybody other than the person who's selling the vehicles illegally. So if somebody's providing a vehicle to them on consignment, they would still be the owner of that vehicle, and I wouldn't anticipate that we would try to seize it. We would be seizing the vehicle that the person that's doing the unlicensed activity would own. Now, part of the process of doing that and part of the investigation, because I suspect in a lot of cases they would purchase a vehicle from somebody but not transfer the title. They would have the old title in hand, so there would be some proof, and you would go back to the previous owner and make sure that they actually sold the vehicle to the person before you could seize it. I suspect there are a lot of cases where they're not legally transferring the title into their own name, and in some cases they may not even legally transfer the title in the name of the person who purchased it from them, that title just gets lost, or there's little or no paperwork. But we'll certainly be happy to work with legislative counsel to make it very clear in statute that we're not intending to go after or seize vehicles that belong to somebody else that hasn't been paid for it, because that's certainly not our intent.
Right. Madam Chair, if I may, that would be certainly something we would have to do, because as currently written, all you have to do is display it or otherwise use it. I mean, you don't have to own it is the point, which I think is what you want.
Yeah.
You want to seize the car that the bad guy or girl owns, and that's what you're trying to do, I think, as opposed to a car there merely selling on consignment or in some other fashion not owning.
Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, that's correct. Thank you.
Vice Chair Gorsuch.
So one quick clarification, and it looks already like I have my own answer, but this is based on a criminal charge, and it's criminal forfeiture, not civil forfeiture. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Gorsuch, the language in the statute, the caption anyway says authorizes civil and criminal forfeiture. So I'm not sure that I know the answer to that question without consulting legislative counsel.
So let me ask it in a different way. We're only going after someone who, after the police or whoever is investigating it, has probable cause to believe that this offense has occurred. Then we would be involved in forfeiture.
Madam Chair, Representative Gorsuch, certainly that's the case. And,
yeah.
and we do not contemplate DMV ever being in the position of seizing a vehicle. They've got no place to put it. They've got no way to. It would
right.
be law enforcement agencies or other folks that are okay. used to doing this process.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Any other questions? It sounds as though this bill needs a little bit more work. There'll be some more amendments coming. Mr. Fuller, you'll let us know.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I will close the hearing on House Bill 2264 and open a hearing on House Bill 2266. Once again, Mr. Brennan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2266 specifies that vehicle dealers may be exempted from weight mile taxes when operating a vehicle owned or controlled by the dealer. When the vehicle is displaying dealer plates and is being operated for test driving purposes in an unloaded condition. This measure has no amendments before us. It has no fiscal or revenue statement issue. We do have a notification that this measure has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue.
Thank you. And we have Mr. Fuller signed up to testify on this bill. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon Vehicle Dealers Association, thank you for hearing this bill. The weight mile tax is a pretty complicated process of tracking how much heavy trucks pay to make sure that they are covering their cost when it comes to damage to the road. So you have the passenger vehicles that pay a gas tax, and you have a weight mile tax for heavy trucks, and there's a rather complicated formula, and I even sat on a task force that occurs every few years that ensures that there's balance between the Oregon Truckers Association and AAA to make sure that nobody else is subsidizing somebody else's use of the highway. So we have no complaints about the weight mile tax, but its intended use is for people that are using commercial vehicles and hauling commercial loads over the road. When a motor vehicle dealer, and there's just one license for motor vehicle dealers, whether it's a heavy tractor trailer rig or whether it's a small smart car, they're all the same kind of license. Heavy truck dealers, especially on traded-in vehicles, they're keeping track of weight mile taxes on dozens, if not hundreds, of vehicles because somebody goes on a test drive and they have to pay a weight mile tax on that test drive. So this is not necessarily a cost issue in terms of paying the weight mile tax. It's more of a paperwork issue that we're asking the legislature to make a policy decision that if a vehicle is in a dealer's inventory, and there's a form that we fill out, it's called a 165 form. When we take a vehicle into our inventory, it indicates that even though the title isn't in our name, that we have possession and ownership of that vehicle temporarily. That if a dealer files a 169 form on a motor vehicle, a heavy truck, that it would not be required to pay the weight mile tax until it's sold to another end user and it's actually being used again on the road for the purposes of commercial transportation as opposed to test drives. So we'd appreciate your consideration and be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
May I ask a clarifying question?
Mr. Brown.
So just for clarity purposes, the dealer who's operating or allowing a test driver to operate this vehicle would be refueling this vehicle and paying a gas tax as a road usage charge, I guess, in lieu of paying the weight mile tax in the event that this bill were to pass?
Madam Chair, Mr. Brennan, it would be my impression that, yeah, they would buy diesel at whatever the gas tax rate would be on diesel. In a lot of cases, when you get a vehicle in on trade that's got a full tank of gas, they're probably not going to fuel that vehicle up during the time that they're test driving it, because those vehicles are the tanks in those vehicles last them an awfully long time. So I haven't surveyed the members to know, but it would be my guess that in a lot of cases they don't ever have to refuel a vehicle for those purposes.
Yes, Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Again, probably a comment or a question for the ether, I suppose, for Darrell. But I wonder what the cost would be for the state at this point. I'm sure we'd have to have Matson with LRO legislative revenue probably run some numbers on that.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Vice Chair Davis, and that would be a real interesting question to ponder, because I think it would probably put very astute economists in a bit of a pickle. You could probably determine how many vehicles, heavy vehicles, are sold in a year.
Yeah.
But for them to try to estimate how many times on average somebody test drives and how long a test drive is in order to make that calculation, I would argue, in the absence of somebody arguing with me, that it's a de minimis amount of money that the highway fund would lose as a result of these test drives.
And Vice Chair Davis, I believe there is a referral, so we will be finding that. Yeah. Yes,
Representative Benz. Thank you. So currently, the car dealers, I believe the car dealerships that I represent, have their own fuel on site. At least some of them do, the larger ones. And I think they pay the fuel tax when they buy the fuel. So this actually just keeps them from paying twice. That'd be my guess, because I'm guessing they'll fill those things up from that tank, having already paid tax on it. I think that's, and I'm just guessing, because I don't honestly remember.
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, for larger dealers, that could very well be correct. If they're buying diesel and they're primarily a heavy truck dealer, I suppose it's possible they could be getting that diesel tax-free, knowing that they're going to be paying weight mile tax on it. There might be a rule or statute someplace that already governs that. I'm just not aware of it.
Madam Chair, follow-up.
Yes.
I was just thinking just the opposite, but it could be. But if they're paying twice, this would be a pretty easy bill to get behind.
Any other comments, Mr. Fuller?
No. Like I said, pretty simple bill, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and hope that it at least makes its way to revenue.
They all appear simple.
That's why I make a living.
Thank you, everyone. I will close the hearing on House Bill 2266. Moving right along, open a hearing on House Bill 2267. And Ms. Joyce, would you like to join us again? Thank you. Mr. Brennan, yes, please.
Thank you. House Bill 2267 authorizes a person to operate a Class 1, 2, or 4 all-terrain vehicle on a portion of a highway if the vehicle meets the specified equipment requirements and the applicable road authority approves the use and posts signs on the area allowed accordingly. It permits a person to permits a person to register a motorcycle originally manufactured for off-road use if the person submits a certificate of approval issued by a licensed off-road motorcycle mechanic. This measure has no fiscal revenue impact statements have been issued on this measure yet. There is no amendments, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon Vehicle Dealers Association. House Bill 2267 comes to you today with two very distinct purposes that just so happen to fit within the same relating clause. So they are two very different portions of this bill. I'll speak briefly to both of them. The first has to do with the use of all-terrain vehicles. And there is some testimony on OLIS from a Lake County commissioner and from some other folks in support of the bill. So in addition to some testimony against it from some other groups as well. So I commend you to take a look at the testimony on OLIS when you get a chance. Essentially, especially in rural parts of the state, people that ride these ATVs for recreational purposes will be in an area and they'll ride for a while and they'll want to go to a different area that's maybe a couple of miles down a gravel road, but that gravel road is maintained by a county or a city, so it's a public road. And in order to move from one area to another, they have to load the vehicles back on their trailer, drive down the road, and unload them again in order to continue to ride, as opposed to just riding down the road itself. And the intent of this bill would be to allow those vehicles that meet with all of the requirements in order to be on a road, that the road authority, as it's mentioned in the bill, which in most cases I believe would be the county, could designate certain roads that would permit these all-terrain vehicles to travel on them. So we're not looking to put a gator down Twilliger curves on a regular basis. That's not the intent. The intent is primarily in rural areas where people are riding these vehicles recreationally already, that it would give some permissive authority to the local government to say, this stretch of this road, we're going to allow ATVs to travel from one riding area to another. So, again, we believe and we know that there's other bills in the process that have differing requirements on them, and happy to work as part of a work group or work through issues that people have, but we're just trying to make the recreational opportunities with these vehicles easier for those that ride them. The second part of the bill, completely different issue, and that has to do with people that buy a dirt bike. They buy an off-road vehicle, a motorcycle, and they ride it around. But and this came to our attention when the economy was really, really bad, that these people would have perhaps a problem with the motor vehicle that they own, and so they would want to take their dirt bike and turn it into a street-legal bike because they couldn't go and afford to buy a new vehicle. So the easiest thing for them to do would be able to drive their motorcycle to and from work or out looking for work. But there is no provision in Oregon law that would allow someone to take an off-road bike and configure it and make it a street-legal bike. They do this in the state of Washington all the time. There's already a process that exists in the state of Washington, so we know it can be done. We know it works. The state of Washington's system is a little more cumbersome than what we've introduced here. In the state of Washington, they actually certify the repair technician to make sure he knows what he's doing or she knows what she's doing in order to do the upkit. In this case, what we've done in an effort to reduce the cost for DMV and to make this as easy as possible would simply be to require that the person that does the upkitting of the bike to be a certified technician by a manufacturer, so we know that they're familiar with the bike and the process, and that they would sign a document saying that this vehicle now meets all of the street legal requirements for a motorcycle to be on a public road. And that puts the liability and the onus on that technician and his employer that they know what they're doing. But it would allow somebody that had an off-road bike to reconfigure it and make it a street legal bike. We think it's a good bill, especially in light of the fact that our economy is, while improving, is still slow to improve, and there are people out there that are trying to figure out ways to title their motorcycles up in Washington at a relative's house so they can get the upkit done and then retitling it back in Oregon because they can do it there and they can't do it here. We'd rather have Oregon dealers doing the business rather than Washington dealers. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions on this two-part bill?
Rolling them to sleep.
Mm-hmm. Chair McEwen and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. Today, this bill mostly representing our safety division. ODOT's got a number of safety concerns, particularly about the ATV portion of the bill. Fundamentally, ATVs are not manufactured for on-road use. That's why they're called off-road vehicles. They don't have the type of equipment that one expects on an on-road vehicle, airbags, crumple zones. Most of them don't have roll bars. So you've got folks riding around in this sort of open configuration, and yet, but for those under the age of 18, folks don't need to be wearing a helmet. And the Specialty Vehicles Institute of America, which is the association of the companies that manufacture and deal in off-road vehicles, has taken the position that these things do not belong on the road and the states shouldn't pass laws regarding allowing them on the road. I've attached that letter to the testimony that I submitted on OLIS. And, you know, two part of the way we achieve good highway safety is folks having an expectation about what other drivers are going to do. So the safety aspect isn't just the person on the ATV and the passenger on the ATV who, you know, like a bicyclist or a pedestrian, if there's a conflict with a regular motor vehicle or a truck, regardless of who's at fault, we know who's going to lose that conflict. It's the person on the ATV. But apart from that, we're also concerned about all the other operators on the highway. So folks, through education and experience, have come to expect certain things on the highway, and an ATV is not one of them. Folks don't expect to see them at all. Folks don't know sort of the habits or what to expect from an ATV rider or an ATV machine. What's the typical braking distance? You know, we come to understand that for a passenger vehicle, but for an ATV, how's it going to turn? How's it going to move through traffic? How's it going to brake? So those are some of the concerns having to do with safety and why these we raise these concerns as you look at this policy decision about the safety of the folks on the ATV and the folks around them on the highway system. The second portion of the bill about the conversion of an off-road motorcycle to street legal. So a couple of things there. The department is sort of unclear on how the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards, the FMVSS, which are the standards for equipment in a street legal vehicle, they're manufacturing standards. So these vehicles, by definition, were not manufactured to have these things. And so there's kind of a question about how you write rules about manufacturing standards that, by definition, are not part of the manufacturing process. Also, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, or NHTSA, a federal group that's the gold standard on safety, has determined off-road motorcycles cannot be legally imported into the U.S. because they can't be made street legal. So concerns about safety, concerns about how this process would work. There is, in fact, an existing process that, to date, no one has yet availed themselves of. And that is that a person could bring to DMV documentation from a manufacturer saying the motorcycle I manufacture can be converted to be street legal, and it has been, and nobody's been able to do that. And so if we are talking about in the bill having mechanics who have been certified by a manufacturer agreeing that these things can be and have been converted, and yet the manufacturers already have that opportunity and have not done so, I'm not sure how much difference there is there, how much we can expect to happen differently. So those are some of the concerns that we raised from the department's point of view.
Representative McLean.
Well, with all of the, you know, I mean, we've got quite a bit of mail here as far as folks who agree or disagree on this one. The rest of them, they don't, are, have been pretty silent on, but this one they're pretty noisy on. And so the two questions that I had is, number one, on this conversion that's happening in Washington State, what are they converting up there? Are they doing the same thing that you want them to do in this state? Because you said you'd rather have Oregon businesses get business versus having our folks have to go up there and get the conversion, and then I guess right in Washington State and Oregon, so they must be okay for both standards. So is that happening? How many people are getting their bikes converted?
Madam Chair, Representative McLean, I don't have a number for you. I do know that they have a process in Washington that allows their dealers to transform a vehicle from an off-road to a street-legal motorcycle. Obviously, if you go to a shop up there and you want it, my understanding is you can buy a kit from the manufacturer, and they'll install all the parts to make it a street-legal, and the repair facility or the maintenance facility is going to charge you a fee for providing that service. So if somebody has an Oregon motorcycle they want converted, they can't do it in Oregon, so Oregon dealers are losing that business because they have to go up to Washington and get it certified up there. They're only going to get it certified up there is if it has a Washington title, so the person would have to figure out a way to get it titled up in Washington, which in theory you live up there to get it titled up there, so that would be a challenge, but that would be the only way somebody can. And I don't know that people specifically are doing it. I just know that in the state of Washington you can do it. In the state of Oregon you can't.
Okay.
So when I talked to the Department of Licensing up there and sort of went through their process, and if there's interest in the committee in moving forward with at least this portion of the bill, I would be happy to even try to get somebody from the Washington Department of Licensing to come down and talk about their process. My understanding is the manufacturers aren't providing the certification that Ms. Joyce talked about. It could just be the manufacturers choose not to do that as part of their business model. Either it doesn't make money for them or they're not interested in the liability. But there is a process that works in Washington. So my intent is to mimic that success in the state of Oregon and allow people to do that, but in such a way that doesn't encumber DMV any more than necessary because of the costs that would be associated with DMV certifying the motorcycle or with DMV certifying the repair technicians that are going to do it. We're happy to put the onus on the dealer that's doing the work.
Okay, that can I just follow up, and I'll make this quick. That's my concern, is just that it sounds like so much more for somebody to oversee, and it would have to be a system that was easy to oversee to be able to be, you know, seamless like you're talking about. The other one is the ATVs, you know, on roads. There, it, from the way I read what you've got as far as words, that it sounds like it could be different in different parts of the state, even in different, you know, different in different parts of the same county, and that ATM, you know, the people that are driving these things would have to really be up on where they could drive it from a off-road site to a on-road and then off-road again. And so it sounds really complicated about the signage that would have to happen and the education that would have to happen, because it seems like once they said, well, you can, you know, you can get from one of these areas to another, they said it was okay for us to go on road, onto the regular road. And it just sounds so complicated on who will know where you can really ride and where you can't. And so I don't know if you have any response to that. There's letters in here that have ideas or thoughts about that. But I don't know. I don't know how to look at that as being practical, as far as just signage telling people what parts of the county or what parts of the state I can ride on the road.
Madam Chair, Representative McLean, the enthusiasts that do this have maps that tell them where they can and can't ride, because you can't take an ATV out just anywhere in the forest and ride it for fun. There are designated places where they have to go. So they already rely on maps, and they know in their, especially in their own area, where they can or can't go. So we'd simply be adding new trail sections, essentially, on the county road is more than likely that's here's where you go. And I suspect any of those enthusiasts that are here or that are listening could provide you with maps that are either available on the internet or in some cases provided by the county sheriff's office or by the county road department, says these are the areas where you can legally ride these vehicles.
Okay.
And they would simply add that to those existing maps.
Thank you. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And of course, this is a repeat conversation. I think this is the third or fourth time we've had this conversation. And I think in part it's driven by the advance in the quality of some of these machines, the mules and the razors and the gators even, or everybody seems to have a side-by-side or even a four-seater. And I've seen them a lot in my part of the world, in every town. I've had different people, John Day and other places, come up and ask me if I would please bring a bill just like this. And I said, well, all the stuff that Representative McLean is mentioning, my question would be this. The people are out there doing this now. They're driving all over the place. I mean, seriously, up and down roads, particularly up in the forests. They're all over, everywhere. And I think that's part of the reason that the forests are trying to close some of the roads, because so many people are zooming around on these things that it's becoming a challenge. So I would guess that insurance is trying to keep up, because there will be more and more accidents involving these types of machines, because that's just how it's going to work. Have you observed, and that in turn will drive all kinds of changes in the safety mechanisms that are in these pieces of equipment. And so I guess I'm asking you, in the 8 years I've been here listening to this conversation, there's been a huge change in the quality of these machines. Has the law kept up? Is there are there new insurance products being offered? And I know when I looked at the last, my son wanted me to buy one of these things, but it was like $20,000. So we don't have one. But I was astounded at all the features those crazy things have. I mean, it's amazing. And a lot of them have to do with safety. So I guess my question is, aren't we moving in the direction where much of the concerns that Representative McLean raises are going to be resolved, just because of the advance of the technology?
Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, first, cost is an issue. I'll tell you when they come out with one with air conditioning, I'll start to look at them as well. Two questions. I can't answer your questions as regards insurance. I do think certainly we're getting better at building these things, and there's a substantially greater variety of them. There are, you know, two-seaters and four-seaters, and I've even seen at Cycle Oregon, not too far from here, some that are 8 and 10 seaters, similar to the dune buggies that you see at the Oregon coast, and certainly the technology with crumple zones and other things that are happening in the motor vehicle industry filter down or filter up and impact them. In terms of people riding all over the place, I would suggest to you that the more legal places we provide people to ride, the less likely they're going to need to go to illegal places to ride. So by opening up and creating more opportunities for them to ride legally, especially especially from one place to another, without having to load and unload their vehicles multiple occasions just to ride around. The easier we make it for them to find designated places, I think the fewer people will find places that they should be riding, that they shouldn't be riding where they are.
We'll follow, Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
You know, in sort of an odd way, they're almost like the drone technology. And I'm not even joking. We're going to have to address the issue, because I see trailer loads of these machines being hauled all over the place, and many of them aren't being hauled to the, what are they called? There's designated areas for these, and they're really big. But there's also an awful lot of space where they're just using them. And legal, illegal, doesn't matter. They're out there.
Madam Chair, yeah, Representative Bentz, I agree. And this sort of an area that I don't deal with, but I think the same is probably happening with boats. With different kinds of watercraft in terms of traditional boats versus the skis, and now you have these things that, you know, you can miniature submarines, and there's all sorts of other things that are out there that are more easily available now than they were years ago, that are transforming the waterways in the same way. And so it's hard to keep up with.
Yeah, if it has to do with water, we don't really have many of those. My point is, I think the discussion you brought before us is a really valid one for a lot of reasons, and it deserves a lot of attention, and it's just an enormous amount of work. I know from our previous hearings over the years that all the stuff that you're mentioning is just hugely complicated. Insurance, signage, all that stuff, very difficult.
Madam Chair and Representative Benson, and it just is an oddity of the law that a two-wheel motorcycle can be running down I-5 at 70 miles an hour, and that's safe, and we're okay with that. But a four-wheel vehicle is not safe enough to go down I-5 when everything about the two of them is the same, except one has two wheels and one has four wheels. The notion that the motorcycle is somehow safer or more stable than the quad would be is a little odd to me, but I'm certainly not advocating, again, that we're putting these vehicles down I-5 or around the Twilliger curves. That's certainly not our intent with the bill.
Yes, Representative Lively.
So if I have this correct, what this bill does is, because it talks about authorizing road authorities to designate. So those road authorities could be cities, counties, whoever, the state. And there's nothing in this bill that tells them what criteria in that to use to do it. It only tells them that they have the authority to do it. So the standards or the criteria could be different amongst all of those jurisdictions?
Madam Chair, Representative Lively, I believe that's correct. The only direction is what has to be on the vehicle in order for it to qualify. Mm-hmm. But I don't recall any specifics that would guide. Our view is the local governments are going to be the best to know what's appropriate for those use.
I have live in an area where there are a plethora of these types of vehicles, because I live very close to the sand dunes. And I recall the days when three-wheelers were the vehicle of choice, and they were the bread and butter of the ER all summer long because they were very unstable, and everybody went over the front and broke their collarbones. But they have evolved tremendously over the last 20 or 25 years, and they're very different now. I see examples down where I live where people camp in a campground in the National Dunes Recreation Area, and they just want to go down the road and get onto the sand road, and so they can get started on their adventure for the day, or they're down on the Rogue River and they're hunting and they want to go from one Forest Service road, you know, a quarter of a mile onto another Forest Service road. I mean, there are lots of people who want this for a very specific and I think understandable reason, but as Representative Benz indicated, the complexity of trying to do this correctly is very difficult. And I know we have, I think, at least one or two other bills that are addressing this, that are in this session, where they're defining vehicles. And it may be that we do want to just pull a work group together and pull all these bills together and have some folks sit down in a room and see what we can come up with to try and answer some of these questions, if they are answerable at this point in time.
Madam Chair, and I have more confidence in this committee to find that sweet spot than I do in any other, so we appreciate you looking at
that. That's very kind of you.
And I hope the other committee...
Daryl, you should run for public office.
Actually, we have four other people who would like to speak to this, so maybe we can have some of the questions answered. What I'd like to do now is call up two witnesses who look like they are going to represent our friends in Washington, Barrett Brown and Tom, is it Nimala?
Yes, ma'am.
Nimala. Thank you. Please join us. Thank you for being here, gentlemen.
Washington County.
Yes. Washington County. All I see is Washington on here. I thought maybe you were the experts on how we do these.
We're good with that.
Bringing us
bring here.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Patrick just enlightened me as to something on this sheet that I didn't notice. Thank you for joining us.
Sure. Thank you, Chairman Cohen, members of the committee. My name is Barrett Brown.
And Barrett, it's McEwen. And everybody gets a pass. I'm a new chair.
Thank you.
We'll start out clean.
One
free
insult per.
You get a pass. Oh,
terrific.
Thank you.
My name is Barrett Brown. I'm a lifelong recreation trail user who grew up with my parents and grandparents riding on trails in Oregon, and lucky enough to raise my son the same way. I'm a longtime former legislative land use director with the Oregon Motorcycle Riders Association and current board member of the National Off-Highway Vehicle Conservation Council. And we discuss, this is a fairly present topic nationwide. I've come to you today to recommend that you actually table this bill for further consideration because of its complexity. In particular, to seek some involvement by the very healthy and active ATV stakeholder community in the state, who I think could provide some good advice on how to put this together. In particular, the ATV Advisory Committee, which was created by statute, in order to help digest these questions before they became potentially contentious or you know, trip hazards for the legislature. If we do look like there's something on the horizon here, many of us would be happy to work in the short term to see if it's possible to patch something together. But you know, it's of course you're not. I'm not suggesting you cede your legislative authority to do work to special interest groups or lobbyists, but you know what I'm talking about. We can provide some help here as a way to clarify how we see this bill. Imagine the Oregon Dunes Recreation Area, an area with bringing millions of dollars of economic activity to a community. If they were to propose building a campground just a quarter mile down a 25 mile per hour road, we would like that community to experience the full economic benefit possible from tourism and so on to develop that recreation activity. If the bill goes forward as it is with this particular large Section 2 column of requirements, we're going to end up subdividing the user community into classes of people who comply. Are people who come from out of state are going to have, they're going to roll right into town and unload and say, wait a minute, I unload with my young children and their vehicles, maybe they can't be certified. And we want to make sure we don't have any compliance trip hazards as well. You know, you can see this happening. The same token, if somebody comes down a trail into a small rural community, and just over there I can see a cafe and a gas station, and the community wants me to be there, my group's going to have to stop and do a little survey of our equipment, and we'll identify the ones who are, you know, do fit these requirements and those who do not. And we're going to hope, as community leaders, we're going to hope that those who aren't compliant are going to stay and wait for their pizza box and their jug of fuel or something to come back, while those who are, in compliance will. And anytime we see compliance difficulties, we want to make sure we are as tight as we can so we succeed. Again, we'd be happy to work with Mr. Fuller and others if we can tighten it up now. We'd just like to, we'd prefer always that these come through a good, healthy public process before they come to you, and that way we can really have the wind at your backs.
Thank you.
Any questions? I'd be happy to answer them.
Sounds good. Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Himala, welcome.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. My name is Tom Niemela, and I am an officer and representative for the Oregon Motorcycle Riders Association. I've been that since the 80s, and we're the statewide sanctioning body for motorbikes and ATVs also. I've been on the board of directors, as Barrett is now, for National Off-Highway Vehicle Conservation Council. NOHVCC, it's going world now, accredited organization for OHV safety and so forth. I'm the Oregon rep. Barrett is the associate rep. He's on the board. I have been on the board. I'm also a representative for American Motorcyclists Association. So, and like gentleman to my left here, I've been a lifelong enthusiast. I grew up in the country, worked with my dad logging to buy my first trail bike. I was so excited. But anyway, so a bill like this, I look at this and I think the intent is definitely there. And we want this. We want to have, pre-2006, we used to be able to make a trail bike street legal with, you know, the minimal requirements that you need. Yeah, you have to have a mirror, you have to have a horn, you have to have lights, brake lights, run lights, so forth. Since then, we have been unable to, and, excuse me, Department of Transportation claims that it's a federal thing. I followed up on it, and it's an EPA thing. And almost all motorbikes nowadays, they have fuel injection, which run cleaner than your lawnmower. It's just crazy. Well, Honda is not going to approve of that because they have to pay a $25,000 fee to get that approved through the EPA, supposedly. Anyway, so we absolutely want this to have move forward, but we just need it fine-tuned. And as far as the monetary reasons, through the NOHVCC, we have a conference every year. And I've been to a couple conferences. There's one trail called the Hatfield-McCoy Trail over in Virginia, and it goes through a plethora of eastern states. And they run side-by-sides. They run ATVs. They run motorbikes. And it's a great family thing. They start off. They unload in town A. They ride 50 miles, 100 miles, depending on what they want. They get gas. They eat in the next town. They stay the night. They have dinner, you know, and they get up the next day and they do the same thing, and they can make these big a week-long vacation trip. These towns, these poor little towns in Virginia and stuff, were just almost dead. Now they're flourishing. They do the same thing in the Paiute Trail system in Utah. So there's a lot of money to be made, a lot of adventure for the users. And it's a great family sport. I love to go out. I've got a street legal motorbike that I pack up and I do overnight trips, and it's wonderful. And so we're absolutely in supportive of this. We just need to go through it with a comb. There's some things in there that just are really negative to OHV use. Any questions?
Yes, Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair. The Oregon, I know there's
Motorcycle Oregon, Riders Association.
I apologize, but there's an Oregon Trails similar to what you've described.
Oh.
And you probably know the name. That
the Backcountry Discovery Route?
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. Could you just talk briefly about what that is?
I've been on almost all those routes. Basically, like I was talking about with the Hatfield-McCoy Trail system, you can, in the past, what I've done is we've all hauled our motorbikes to, last trip was in Lapine. We unloaded there at a friend's house. We packed our sleeping bags or whatever else we needed, and we took off. The first night we stayed at Christmas Valley. The next day we stayed at Lakeview, and do all these back roads, and the scenery is so stunning, and it's wonderful. It's wonderful.
And you can follow up?
Yes.
And it's possible, I understand, because I've had a friend do it, go from the California to the Washington border.
Absolutely. That's the main path, north to south, yeah, or vice versa.
So it's a fantastic thing.
It absolutely is.
Thank you. Representative Bentz.
Thank you.
Yes.
So you referenced your organization, if the will of the committee at some point was to ask for your help, how long does it take and who does the work?
Well, we think, as we see it, we want to try and get something put together by the end of the week, very soon.
Hold on, Madam Chair.
Yes.
That was not the answer I was expecting.
Nor I. Light speed.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
We might want to ask the Madam Chair just a suggestion. I thought it was going to take a year.
Yeah, so. That's what I figured. Yeah.
We
won't move that fast, I promise.
Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, we the process I described, the healthy wind at your back process I described, would take a year. If we saw this with some momentum and we wanted to get the absolute best package we could put together, we've already discussed trying to commit to getting that done by the end of the week. It may not be possible to do so, but
Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
So when we've done this previously in other situations, mm-hmm. where we had the Oregon Law Commission help us on the estate tax rebuild, and that did take a full year, and we got just an incredible product back. I mean, it was really great. And the best part about it is we were hardly any of us involved. And and other people, experts, came in and put a package together, did all the work, had everybody yell at them. And when they brought it back, they had consensus, and they were ready to go. And so is that what you're telling us?
That's precisely what I'm getting at.
Thank you.
Well, and with the plethora of bills that we have forthcoming, and we may not have seen the end of them in this session, this may be a good way to manage this as time goes on if we decide we do want to take an opportunity to make some of these changes. So I think we have a little bit of work to do as a committee. We will look to all of you who are experts to guide us should the time come. And I think we have a couple of other people who wanted to testify on this bill. So without any further questions for this panel,
thank you.
We'll excuse
thank you.
You
very much.
Thank you very much for being here today. And I'd like to call Ethan Ludwig and John Lane, please. Welcome, gentlemen. Thank you so much for being in front of our committee today.
Thank you for having us.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair and the members of the committee, I don't do this very well, so bear with me.
Just fine.
My name's Ethan Ludwig. I'm the vice president of the Emerald Trail Riders Association. I belong to OMRA and the AMA as well. That's the American Motorcyclist Association, not the American Medical Association. I would like to basically start out by saying that I'm in total agreement with Barrett and Tom there. Currently, though, I'm very concerned as well about the language of the current bill. And I'd just like to read this briefly, if you'll bear with me. The OHV community would very much like to have the opportunity to ride on some roads. Many OHV trails within a recreation area can be linked together by a short ride on a dirt road that may be restricted to licensed vehicles only. I personally enjoy rides that take all day. Being able to stop in a small town for fuel and food vastly improves the quality of that day's experience. I have been on group rides in Idaho and Utah where our lunch stop provided a few $100s for that community. There's a growing popularity in adventure riding among all OHV user groups. This is when you go for a ride on your OHV with the intent of traveling a long distance and having a long adventure. The most rewarding adventures are the ones that incorporate a destination, even if it's for a hot lunch and a milkshake. Adventure riders often credit card their way along, eating in restaurants and staying in hotels at night. Adventure riding is very popular in Mexico, Idaho, Utah, and other areas that have chosen to allow OHVs access to their rural communities by being able to ride legally on some roads. Some of Oregon's rural communities want to invite OHV recreationalists into their town, and the OHV recreationalists would very much enjoy having access to the goods and services. The intent of HB 2267 is a very good one that would support our rural communities and the 22% of Oregonians that enjoy recreating on OHVs. However, the language of the bill does not support this intent. Please consider the state's ATV Advisory Committee, the Emerald Trail Riders Association, Oregon Motorcycle Riders Association, and users like myself as resources related to the OHVs. And again, I offer my time in making this a bill that works.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you for being here today. Any questions for this gentleman?
Thank you.
All right. Sir?
Thank you.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, thank you for giving me and other operators of all-terrain vehicles a chance to voice an opinion on House Bill 2267. My name is John Lane. I'm the vice president of a nonprofit called the Oregon Outback Association, whose goal is to assist backcountry adventurists of all methods by marking key intersections with identifying numbers so that a person can locate their position on maps and navigational devices. I'm also an instructor for the ATV Safety Institute and a master instructor for the Oregon State University 4-H Youth Training Program. And when Tom Niemela was up here, you were talking about, Madam Chair, the backcountry discovery route. I want to say that that backcountry discovery route does join border to border. However, about 10 to 20% of that is closed to all-terrain vehicles that are not street legal. Mm. I've been working with the Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management to find legal ways around those closed portions to some success, but not 100% success. We're still working on that. We recognize that the intent of this bill is to allow the use of all-terrain vehicles on rural highways. However, as it is written, House Bill 2267 would require the county or township to post signs on every road they wish to allow open to all-terrain vehicles, effectively closing all existing highways currently open to all-terrain vehicles, at least until they can create and install proper signage. The magnitude of this project and the associated cost would most likely be a net loss to the user, because there are hundreds, if not thousands, of miles of road highway in eastern Oregon that is currently open to all-terrain vehicles. And recognizing that Oregon Statute 801305 defines a highway as, I quote, every public way, road, street, thoroughfare, and place, including bridges, viaducts, and other structures within the boundaries of the state, open, used, or intended for use of the general public for vehicles or vehicular traffic as a matter of right. Chair McEwen, members of the committee, that means that every road open to vehicles, passenger vehicles or such, whether it's paved, dirt, gravel, those are all highways in the state of Oregon. We don't necessarily want to ride on paved highways. If it's for a short distance to join trail to trail, that would be great. Then we would support signing shared paved highways, but signing the off-road dirt gravel roads in the Forest Service or BLM land in the vast reaches of eastern Oregon would be way too much work. Because of that, we are against the passage of this bill as it is written. Because counties and townships are already passing ordinance to allow ATVs on certain roads within their jurisdictions, we see an opportunity to provide a framework for those counties and towns, but it needs some work first. To reiterate, the current language of House Bill 2267 will not work. We would like to work with you on this. A statewide platform that spells out minimum age requirements, training requirements, and equipment standards are all excellent things to have in a state statute. But they must make sense. Many of the requirements in this bill do not. If done right, the counties and towns can base their ordinance on what the state mandates. They can provide additional restrictions if necessary, such as which specific roads would remain closed to all-terrain vehicles. The single largest impediment facing those who currently legally operate all-terrain vehicles on Oregon's highways is an unfortunate side effect from Oregon Statute 821.200, Section 1, Line F, which says an all-terrain vehicle and snowmobile cannot cross a highway within 100 feet of an intersecting highway. If an all-terrain vehicle is on a highway, it is technically in an intersecting highway if it reaches an intersection. Even if both of those highways are open to ATV use, it technically cannot cross. That's as it is written today. This is another example of an unintended consequence of well-meaning legislation. Law enforcement officers are either unaware of this or have chosen to ignore the statute. The problem arises when a town has opened their roads to all-terrain vehicles, but the vehicles cannot legally cross intersections, especially those of state or federal highways. ORS 821.200 does a good job telling the rider how to cross all highways safely. In much the same way as our neighboring states, we just need to strike that one line out, 821.200.1F. Chair McEwen, members of the committee, promoting the sensible use of all-terrain vehicles in the remote regions of our state is a tremendous economic benefit to many of those small towns which rely on tourism to sustain the fuel, food, and lodging industries. It may be possible to correct this bill. If not, it should fail. I repeat our desire to help the state write language that makes sense. Again, I thank you for your time and attention to this issue. The Oregon Outback Association is at your disposal.
Thank you. Thank you. That's very interesting to me. Could you give us an example of a place where this is working under the current statute, where a community or a county or a small town has designated a parcel that you could cross?
Madam Chair,
it sounds like we may have some solutions that are already there that we're not aware of.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Yes, the town of Lakeview recently passed ordinance, as well as the county of Lake County, to allow ATVs on certain roads within their jurisdictions. The major impediment to the town of Lakeview is when an ATV wants to cross an intersection, they are legally in an intersecting highway, so that 100-foot limitation makes it impossible for them to cross highways. And the issue in the town of Lakeview is specifically Highway 395, and there's another intersecting state highway, I think it's 140, that goes through the town of Lakeview. The town has decided they're going to look the other way. They just want this to happen because they're hurting for money over there right now. They have restaurants that are closing early and losing days of when they're open. It's a serious issue, and they look at this as a way to bring money from the trail systems, the backcountry discovery route, into town so they can fuel up, stay in their hotels, eat their food. And they've already enjoyed a little bit of benefit from this. Last October, I did a 740-mile adventure ride, and we stayed in different towns every night. We didn't trailer it. We rode right into town, and that was because we were in Lake County. Mm. We had to do some, I'm not going to say we broke any laws, but we had to do some creative ways of getting gas and getting our food and getting to our hotel.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that answers your question, Madam Chair.
I believe it does. Representative Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Well, this all sounds like Lake County is being
discretionary
in how they deal with things, which I think in your example is probably a good thing. I think that this is more of a comment than a question. I think that we have a lot of problems in rural Oregon in terms of economic development, and if you can take something that people are there to enjoy and also tie in economic development with it, hence tourism, I think that we should do whatever we can to create a product that's workable for everybody.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Comments, questions? Well, we appreciate your expertise and your experience, and I believe there will be more work to be done here, and we appreciate your willingness to participate.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Thank you.
Thank you
for
very
confronting
much.
The issue as well.
Thank you. Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that wanted to comment on this particular bill? We had 6 people signed up. I believe we've heard them all. All right, thank you. I will close the hearing on House Bill 2267 and open a hearing. Oh, by the way, there is more written testimony on OLIS on this particular issue. I know you're all aware, but for the audience, there are other documents that have been presented to the committee on OLIS. And I will open a hearing on House Bill 2268. Mr. Brennan, one more time.
Two more times, but one more time.
One more time now. Yeah.
Thank you. House Bill 2268 deletes the exemption from odometer disclosure for vehicles that are at least 10 years old at the time of change of ownership. As with the other measures, we have no amendment before us. We have received a no revenue impact statement, but have not received a fiscal impact statement.
Mr.
Madam
Foley.
Chair, members of the committee, remember me?
Yes.
Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon Vehicle Dealers Association. We're down to the last two. I appreciate your patience. House Bill 2268 hitchhikes on some good work that you guys did a couple of years ago regarding odometer disclosures. There's a federal law that if a vehicle is 10 years old or newer, when the title transfers on that vehicle, that there has to be a secure odometer form filed so you know what the odometer reading on that form is. After a vehicle reaches its 10th birthday, you're no longer required by federal law to list that odometer as part of a sale. The federal law doesn't preclude a state from going beyond that 10 years. It's just a 10-year limit at the federal level. So the state of Oregon and a lot of other states just adopted that 10-year rule as their rule.
What we discovered was, in a lot of cases, when people were transferring a title on a motor vehicle, even though the mouse language on the title transfer form said you don't have to do this if your vehicle is 10 years old or older, people were still putting the odometer reading in there, but DMV wasn't recording that number. So a couple of years ago, you guys passed a law that told DMV that, well, if they voluntarily provide the number, at least write it down in the record so it's there. There's no reason not to use that information.
I think some of us voted on that particular vote.
Quite a few of you did.
Correctly.
I don't remember too many people voting against it. This takes it one step further. We believe it's a good consumer protection provision to simply require anybody who's transferring a vehicle to write down the odometer when they transfer the vehicle, regardless of the age. And the reason why that's becoming more and more significant, as you can see it in my testimony on OLAS, is that people are holding their cars longer. The average age of the fleet, if you will, of vehicles on the roads in the United States is getting older. Vehicles are lasting longer than they used to, so people can hold them longer. In some cases, people are holding them longer simply because they can't afford to get another vehicle. And the people who need the protection of an odometer disclosure are generally not the people with new vehicles. It's the people with older vehicles that have problems that we talked about in a previous bill where people are rolling back the odometers. It used to be it was a craft to roll back the old odometers that were in cars that you actually get in there and had to get the odometer and physically roll it back. Well, as you know now, most cars have a digital odometer. Well, guess how easy it is to roll back a digital odometer? Just Google it, and they'll give you the instructions on how to do it. It's not that hard. We have people now, as cars become more complex, so they're doing it remotely. You don't even have to get in interface with the car. You can probably just break into the car and roll the odometer back. So as these sort of what I would call a first-generation digital odometer cars get older and older, the likelihood of those getting rolled back becomes easier and easier. And so we think when somebody transfers a vehicle, regardless of the age, they ought to write down what that odometer statement is. And then when somebody goes and gets a Carfax statement, that Carfax statement is going to list all the odometer disclosures during the history mm-hmm. of that car. Mm-hmm. And if at any point in there the vehicle has fewer miles than it did before, the Carfax will give you an alert and say, we think there could be a fraud issue here. It could be a legitimate reason. But we just want to let you know that there's a discrepancy, and prior to purchasing the vehicle, you ought to check it out. And there are circumstances where there may be a good explanation. There are certainly on older vehicles that have odometers that don't have enough digits, where there are cases where people have put together cars and you got an engine from one car and something from another where you just don't know what odometer number to write down, and there ought to be an opportunity, and I believe there is, to say, I don't believe this number is reliable. This is what it's telling me. But because of the age of the vehicle or problems with the vehicle, I'm sort of saying I don't believe that this, I believe this may not be accurate. But in the vast majority of cases, people should easily be able to write down that number and say, this is what the odometer number is on the day that I sell the car. And we believe that information is useful to people that are making those purchases. And we'll acknowledge up front that most states aren't doing this. I think Oregon ought to lead the nation. There are some other states that are doing it, but we ought to be part of the states that go ahead on consumer protection issues and say that this is an important and easy thing to do. DMV will give you a fiscal on it. They'll say that it's pretty expensive, and it may be because you're taking cases where the employees are keying in, where they're not keying in a number now. In the case of a lot of the vehicles, now all of a sudden they're having to key in all of those numbers. So there will be some additional staff time. It's the difference between hitting the tab button and having to put in a 3 or 4 or 5 digit, how many digit number. And those numbers are checked and double checked. And so we understand that there is some staff time that will be required in order to comply with this. And we think it's money well spent. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Yes. Thank you. Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Darrell. I would like to know that whether or not the strategy from Ferris Bueller's Day Off would work with modern automobiles, because I'm convinced the reason it did not work for Mr. Bueller is the fact that it was a 1960s Ferrari and an Italian vehicle, which I understand was not possible. But
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Davis, I know it works with German vehicles. I'm not sure about some of the others. I've tried that on a couple of my own, and just it never really seemed to work. But perhaps we can put something in statute. To
well, Mr. Fuller,
I remember it didn't work out all that well for Ferris Bueller.
No, it
didn't.
I seem to recall the last time the bill came that we passed in the last session, I confessed that when I was 16, I drove to Eugene without the permission of my mom or my dad. And I had a very good friend that was a very creative young man who taught me how to crawl underneath my dad's Pontiac and roll the odometer back. But it took a little effort. I actually had to get under the car with some tools. And it was very effective, and my dad didn't figure it out until I confessed to him about probably 30 years later when it was very safe.
And I suspect the statute of limitations.
I had tampered with his vehicle.
Yeah, statute of limitations. Yeah.
Yes, the statute of limitations on the father-daughter relationship had passed. But it was an adventure in those days. But, you know, all kidding aside, if there's, something that we need to consider here, we certainly will. But we appreciate you coming and talking to us about it. I'll look to Ms. Joyce to see if she would like to comment on this particular bill. I have you down on my witness list if you'd like to join us.
And I will say my kids can talk on their phones through my car. I can't. I don't know how to do it. But I guess it's so my kids could probably roll back the odometer on their cars.
From their phone.
Yeah, from their phone.
Exactly.
Gary Hutchinson was the young man that taught me how to turn that odometer back.
Bring him in.
I haven't seen him in 40 years.
On record now. Been exposed.
Chair McEwen and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, I will not be confessing to any felonies.
Smart woman, thank you.
Thank you so much. A couple items about this. Again, the history on it, right, the federal law says 9 years in newer vehicles, you must disclose your odometer. After that, you can be an exempt, and folks are still exempt under current Oregon law. And as you all noted, in 2013, you passed the legislation to require DMV to record that electronically. Of course, it had always been recorded on the paper form when folks turn it in. It's part of the permanent record. But adding it to the computer system, and just as a piece of history, I mean, the block on that existed as a check to ensure that DMV workers are entering things accurately. But so we lifted that, and now when folks do voluntarily give an odometer reading after 10 years and older vehicle, it goes into the system, it gets printed on the title. So this bill then would lift the exemption completely and require all of us to record that odometer reading when we transfer title on a vehicle. But inherent in the 9-year limit in the federal statute is a recognition that as a vehicle becomes older and older and goes through multiple transitions, the odometer reading becomes inherently less reliable. So you can have mechanical problems, you can have a transfer where somebody didn't record it and now the next person does record it. You could potentially have rollbacks, although there's no real evidence that that's a huge problem in Oregon. So other issues where it becomes less and less reliable. So it's one thing when you go to Oil Can Henry's and they record your odometer and it shows up on Carfax, that's one thing. When it shows up as the DMV recorded your odometer at a certain level, it puts a bit of an imprimatur on it of authenticity or accuracy. It's printed on your title, and so there's that. So the concern is that it offers a level of authenticity or reliability that simply isn't there any more than what the guy at Oil Can Henry's reads and puts into Carfax. Some other issues. A number of customers will not know that this is a new requirement. As much as we put out information about changes in the law, hundreds of thousands of people today do not include their odometer reading when they transfer the title. So what you do today is if you mail that title in and it comes in and there's something wrong about it, anything, the fee, anything else, it goes into what DMV calls special processing. And basically it gets mailed back to the customer. Sorry, you did this wrong. We're rejecting your transaction. So with hundreds of thousands of people who would now be required to include their odometer and they don't, all those things are going back. Or the folks who show up at the field office in one vehicle and they're holding the title to a different vehicle, and they haven't filled out that odometer, they're sent away to do it to come back later. So the question is the value of the inclusion of this information in exchange for the inconvenience to customers, the inherent lack of reliability to an older odometer number.
Questions? Representative Hack.
I've been way too quiet today. I'm just curious. Thank you, Madam Chair. I see the benefit in that it would be a benefit to the consumer in knowing, and then they obviously would have to go after the person that sold them the vehicle. Do you really think that that benefit is going to outweigh the cost of what it's going to cost DMV to do that? And then we're going to see more in small claims going after people to that have given them, you know, sold them a car that they thought had 80,000 miles and it has 180. I mean, what do we, is, I mean, at some point, I don't know, I guess I'm asking if the real benefit to this is that you see, at some point we have to trust people and they've got to do their due diligence, I guess.
Madam Chair, Representative Hack, I think it's part of the due diligence process. People should be careful about what they buy. The world of caveat emptor should still exist. But the primary way when you're purchasing a used vehicle that you do your due diligence is you look at the vehicle history so that you know what you're buying. If somebody has successfully rolled back an odometer, even by a few thousand miles, and there are certain levels at which a mileage reading is more significant than others. When you roll past 100,000, for example, there's a big loss in the value of the vehicle. So if you have a vehicle you're trying to sell and it's got 105,000 miles on it, if you can roll that back to 95,000 miles, the value to you is fairly significant. And the cost to the consumer when they buy a vehicle that has a rolled odometer is significant. You're paying higher insurance costs because the value of the vehicle is more. You're paying a higher repair and maintenance cost because you thought the vehicle was newer and it's older, so things are going to run out faster. You're paying more for the vehicle at retail than you would otherwise because you think the vehicle is newer than it is. So for those Oregonians that are the victim of odometer fraud, having another tool where they could verify that an odometer has not been rolled back, I think, is extremely important. When we passed the legislation 2 years ago, and I should have included it in this time, we did got numbers nationally. And if I remember correctly, and I'll get the information and send it to you, I think the estimate at the national level, then based on the number of sales of vehicles in Oregon, that Oregon consumers were losing somewhere in the neighborhood of $3 million a year in value. Because they were buying odometer cars whose odometers had been rolled back.
That's what I
now,
wanted to know.
Now, will there be a cost of getting consumers used to doing this new thing? Well, certainly there is. There was a cost to getting people to wear their seatbelts all the time, but there was a value to doing that. I suspect DMV can be pretty effective by putting a bright colored notice and boxes and notices out when people are transferring their titles. This box that you required to fill in this box to transfer the title. While there will be an increase in those people that get them sent back, or there'll be an increase of people that leave DMV and have to go get that information and return it, I suspect people will only have to experience that once before they learn that lesson. And I think an awful lot of people will figure it out ahead of time. So, there's no numbers attached to it, but I believe the value to the consumers is worth the cost that it would take to do this.
Well, we see you back here. Is there going to be a criminal charge against these folks who do this?
Madam Chair, Representative Hack, I promise we won't try to seize the vehicles of people that don't put their odometer readings on their disclosures.
Thank you.
We have one more bill we'd like to get through. Any other comments or questions for this panel? We'll race to the end. Closing the House Bill 2268, and we were going to open on House Bill 2886. Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, members.
Actually, Mr.
Committee.
Brennan.
I can just do it real quick, Madam Chair. This bill provides clarification regarding who may participate in vehicle dealer auctions or display of vehicles without holding a valid dealer certificate. No amendment, no revenue impact. No statement yet received from LFO.
Thank you. Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon Vehicle Dealers Association. This one really is the closest to a housekeeping amendment of the bills that you've seen today. As you know, if somebody is an independent contractor, they're required to have all of the tools of their trade in order to be an independent contractor. You can't be an independent contractor and use the computer and the equipment of the person you're contracting with because you're supposed to be independent. Otherwise, you become an employee.
Because of the way the statute is written, there's a lack of clarity on whether a vehicle dealer who is buying and selling cars at an auction, they have these big regional auctions where only dealers are allowed, and they buy cars and sell cars at the wholesale level, bring them back to their dealerships and retail them. Rather than having an employee drive to those auctions and drive back in the cost, a lot of dealers will hire an independent contractor to be their buying and selling agent at these big auctions. And in some cases, these buying agents have three or four different dealerships that they may work for. But because they're independent contractors, they ought to have all of the tools of the trade in order to buy and sell motor vehicles. And in Oregon, that means they're required to be licensed as a motor vehicle dealer in order to sell even a single vehicle for profit as part of your business. The way our statutes are supposed to be set up is if that's how you make your living, then you have to be a licensed dealer. But some of the auctions are allowing people to come in and buy and sell on their behalf without having the benefit of a dealer's license under the auspices that they're working for me, and therefore they don't have to have a dealer's license. Well, if you're an employee, that makes sense. But we believe that both the independent contractor statutes and the dealer statutes, the way they're written, ought to be clear, and that's why we're trying to clarify it, that if you're an employee of a dealership, you can buy and sell at an auction on behalf of that dealer. But if you're an independent contractor, then your independent status means you ought to have a dealer's license as well. And the concern there, if you have four or five dealers that you're buying for, is that it's real easy to buy two or three for yourself and then just put them out there and sell them on your own, and then you're in the process of retailing those vehicles without a license as well. So we simply are using the language here to make it very clear that whether you're an in-state dealer or an out-of-state dealer, if you're buying or selling cars at these dealer-only auctions as an independent contractor, then you need to get a dealer's license in order to do that.
Thank you.
I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Daryl. Just looking at the actual bill and some of the language that was deleted, I'm just wondering if it goes beyond the intent of what you're discussing here, because it's deleting language talking about vehicle dealers in other jurisdictions are authorized to come in, and then it's reproducing that language. Do you know why there's a rather large deletion and then a rather large addition?
Madam Chair, Representative Davis, and I'm not an attorney, and I certainly don't want to do legislative counsel's job for them, but I think in some cases what they're doing is removing and condensing it into the new statutory language. As I recall, and I'll have to check and get the answer back to you, part of the confusion in terms of how the statute was interpreted is because the language talked about certified dealers here and it talked about licensed dealers over here. And as I spoke to the committee earlier, Oregon certifies instead of licenses. And so the intent here was to clarify whether you're an in-state dealer or an out-of-state dealer, whether you're licensed or whether you're certified, in order to come and be a participant in one of these dealer-only auctions. You had to be an employee of a licensed or certified dealer, whether you were in or out of state, or you had to have an Oregon dealer's license.
Any other questions?
I have a question.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've heard quite a bit today about the certification for dealers. Is that a difficult process to do? Will this be a hardship on folks who are independent contractors now?
Madam Chair, Representative Hack, I don't believe it's a difficult process. It does require, if I remember correctly, a criminal background check. Is that correct? I think it requires a criminal background. You're required to be bonded. And for some people, that may be a difficulty getting a bond if they've had financial difficulties. We would argue that the purpose of the bonding process, not only to protect the consumers, but to ensure that people are good fiduciaries with other people's money. But the application in and of itself is not a substantially lengthy application.
Thank you.
Questions? Well, look at that. Ms. Joyce, did you have a comment on this bill?
Chairman Kuhn and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. It's just here mostly to answer questions, but I think directly to Vice Chair Davis's question. I agree that I think it's more of a reorganization issue. The only change I really see in this bill is it goes from using the language dealers and their authorized representatives to dealers and their employees. Employee is a term of art and means something different. And so that's the change I see in this bill.
Thank you for that clarification.
Did you have anything else to add, Mr. Fuller?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good bill should pass.
Thank you very much.
Oh, I've heard that before.
On that note, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2886. And I believe that there's nothing for the good of the order. We are adjourned 2 minutes late. My apologies. Good of the order. We are adjourned 2 minutes late. My apologies. But there's nothing for